This is the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Welcome to our evening program. It's Tuesday, July 26, 2011. Your readers tonight are Judy Bobe, Mark Turner, and Laura Arwood. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. We will begin reading the USA Today Newsline section, followed by Moneyline, Sports, and Life. At 8:30, our feature program will be Independent Living. And now we have Judy with the television listings.
And tonight, on ABC at 8 o'clock to 8:30, Wipeout. At 9 to 9:30, 100 Ways to Leave a Game Show. At 10 to 10:30, Combat Hospital. And at 11 o'clock, the local news. On CBS at 8 o'clock, NCIS until 8:30. 9 to 9:30, NCIS Los Angeles. From 10 to 11, 48 Hours Mystery, and again at 11, the local news. Fox, at 8 o'clock to 9 o'clock, Hell's Kitchen. At 9 to 10, Master Chef. And from 10 on, local news and programming. NBC, from 8 to 8:30, It's Worth What? From 9 o'clock to 10:30, America's Got Talent. And at 11 o'clock, the local news. PBS at 8 o'clock to 8:30, History Detectives. At 9 o'clock, Frontline. At 10 o'clock to 11, POV. And at 11:30, Charlie Rose. On the CW network, at 8 o'clock to 8:30, 90210. At 9 to 9:30, Shedding for the Wedding, and from 10 on, local news. At MyNet, MNT, at 8 o'clock to 8:30, Are You Smarter Than a Fifth Grader? And again at 8:30, Are You Smarter Than a Fifth Grader? At 9 o'clock to 9:30, Don't Forget the Lyrics, and again at 9:30 to 10, Don't Forget the Lyrics, and from 10 o'clock on, local news. At ION, from 8 to 9, Without a Trace. At 9 o'clock, Criminal Minds. At 10 o'clock, Criminal Minds. At 11 o'clock, Criminal Minds. And at 12 o'clock, Criminal Minds. And on the cable stations, A&E, at 8 o'clock, Gene Simmons Family Jewels. At 9 o'clock, we have Gene Simmons Family Jewels again. At 10 o'clock, Gene Simmons Family Jewels. And at 11 o'clock, Gene Simmons Family Jewels. And on AMC, at 8 o'clock, A Few Good Men. At 11 o'clock, A Few Good Men again. Discovery Channel at 8 o'clock has The Deadliest Catch. At 9 o'clock, The Deadliest Catch. At 10 o'clock, The Deadliest Catch. The Deadliest Catch again at 11. And at ESPN, 8 o'clock, the 2011 World Series of Poker. And again at 9, the 2011 World Series of Poker. And at 10 o'clock, Baseball Tonight. And at 11 o'clock, Sports Center. TBS, at 8 o'clock, The Office. At 8:30, The Office. At 9 o'clock, The Office. 9:30, The Office. 10 o'clock, The Office. 10:30, The Office. And at 11 o'clock, Conan. And at TNT, Rizzoli and Isles. And that's at 8 o'clock. Memphis Beat starts at 9 o'clock. Hawthorne starts at 10 o'clock. Memphis Beat again at 11 o'clock. And USA at 8 o'clock. Law and Order Special Victims Unit, followed by White Collar at 9 o'clock, 10 o'clock, Covert Affairs, at 11 o'clock, Necessary Roughness. And those are the TV listings for tonight, Tuesday the 26th.
Thank you. And now, our USA Today cover story. Need a job? Move to Texas. Finding work may not be quite that simple, but it sure seems that way. While nation's job growth has limped along since the economic recovery began 2 years ago, the Lone Star State is enlarging payrolls in Texas-style fashion. This is from the USA Today's series called American Jobs 2011. From June 2009 to June 2011, the state added 262,000, or half of the U.S.'s 524,000 payroll gains, according to the Federal Reserve Bank of Dallas and the Bureau of Labor Statistics. Even by a more conservative estimate that omits states with net job losses, Texas advances made up 30% of 1 million additions in the 34 states with net growth. That stunning showing could play a role in the presidential race. Texas Governor Rick Perry is signaling he may run for the Republican nomination. If he does, he is likely to ground his campaign in his state's outsized job growth. Texas's gains are partly a reflection of its population growth, but the recent job gains are outpacing the rate of population growth in Texas, the nation's second largest state, with 25 million residents, about 8% of the U.S. population. The state payrolls have risen 2.9% since the end of the recession, third behind North Dakota and Alaska, and far outpacing the USA's 0.4% growth, according to the BLS. Also, Texas's 8.2% unemployment rate is well below the nation's 9.2%. Moody's economic Ed Friedman says, "For one large state to grow jobs so much faster than the rest of the nation is very unusual." Economists point to an array of factors, including high energy prices that set off an oil drilling frenzy, rising exports, and a conservative banking industry that helped the state sidestep the housing crash. Yet while energy has been a spark, employment in natural gas, oil, and other mining sectors rose by 45,000, or 23% since the recession ended. While that has been a spark, growth has been broad-based. During the past 2 years, professional and business services added 74,000 jobs, education and health care gained 91,000, and leisure and hospitality grew by 29,000, according to the BLS. State officials cite a pro-business climate that Perry helped foster that's drawing scores of businesses from high-cost states, a trend that took on urgency for firms that got lean during the economic downturn. The 10-year Texas governor is, quote, "really focused on creating an environment where people can risk their capital and get a return on their investment, and that in turn creates jobs for Texans," end quote, says Lucy Nash, spokeswoman for the state's Economic Development Office. Nash notes Texas has no state or corporate income tax and keeps regulations at a minimum to allow businesses to grow quickly. She says Perry also has worked to develop a skilled workforce by requiring additional public school classes and pushing through tort reform to limit frivolous lawsuits. The state, meanwhile, has doled out more than $600 million in grants and investments since 2003 to recruit out-of-state companies and help Texas firms expand. Does Perry really deserve credit? Yet some question Perry's role in the so-called Texas miracle. James Galbraith, a professor of government at the University of Texas Austin, largely attributes the state's growth to the energy and export booms. Texas, he notes, has never had an income tax. From 1990 to 2000, before Perry took office, Texas payrolls swelled 36% compared to 21% for the nation. Quote, "Rick Perry did not come and find a high tax, high service state and dismantle it," Galbraith says. For something to contribute, there has to be a change. There's been a change in oil prices," end quote. Others say the state's low tax burdens exact a high cost. fewer state services. Perry, for example, refused to raise taxes to close a $27 billion budget gap last spring. Instead, the legislature slashed more than $4 billion in funding for public schools the next 2 years, a move that's likely to lead to tens of thousands of teacher layoffs. Says Scott McCrown, "We're not preparing our children to compete in tomorrow's economy." Scott Crown, head of Texas's Center for Public Policy Priorities. Texas ranks 44th in the USA in per capita in per student expenditures and 43rd in high school graduation rates, McCown said. 17% of Texans lived below the poverty level in 2009, compared to 14% for the nation. The state leads in the percentage of the population with no health insurance and was ninth in income inequality in the mid-2000s. The latest data available, according to McCown and the Economic Policy Institute. McCown says Texas should not serve as a job growth paradigm for the rest of the nation. Quote, if you're saying you want to look like Texas, you're saying you want to be poor and have less health care, end quote. The state's relatively low wages, particularly for low-skilled jobs, stems in part from its status as a right-to-work state with little unionization. That dampens consumer spending and limits economic growth, McCown says. In June, average hourly earnings for private sector employees in Texas were about 5% lower than the U.S. average. But Mark Dotzor, chief economist at Texas's A&M Real Estate Center, says the state's lower pay helps it compete in a global economy. Quote, either you choose to have low-wage jobs or you choose to have no jobs at all, end quote. The state's reasonable cost of living, he adds, makes it possible for many residents to live comfortably on lower salaries. The Dallas area ranks 10th in housing affordability among 82 metro areas with more than 1 million residents, while Houston is 15th, according to the Demographia International Housing Affordability Survey. That's partly because Texas has an abundance of cheap land, another draw for firms looking to relocate. Other reasons for the state's robust job growth? 1. The energy boom. Oil prices have nearly tripled since 2009. High prices spark more exploration and production. Meanwhile, technological breakthroughs have let companies extract natural gas embedded in shale deposits. Barnett Shale in Fort Worth is one of the USA's largest gas fields, and drilling began at the Eagles Ford Shale in South Texas in 2008. The number of oil and gas rigs in the state has jumped to 850 from 330 in July 2009, says Anna Orcosa, economist for IHS Global Insight. Each rig employs a few dozen workers and leads to hiring by engineering firms, pipe builders, and other services. 2. Exports. Overseas shipments by Texas's strong computer, electronics, petrochemical, and other industries rose 21% last year, compared to 15% for the nation, according to Dallas's Federal Reserve Bank. The state also benefits from its proximity to Latin American countries that are big importers of U.S. goods, Friedman says. The surge creates jobs for Texas manufacturers and ports. No housing crash is the third reason. Texas never had a housing boom, but it also avoided the bust that disseminated consumer credit and housing construction in much of the rest of the nation. While prices of single-family homes more than doubled from January 2000 to their mid-2000 peaks in cities such as Los Angeles, Miami, and Las Vegas, they rose less than 27% in the Dallas-Fort Worth market, according to S&P's Case-Shiller Home Price Index. Meanwhile, Texas banks, burned by the savings and loan crisis in the 1980s, were less eager than those in other states to approve risky mortgages. And Texas law limits mortgage debt, including home equity loans, to 80% of a home's value, says Dallas Fed Vice President Mine Yuckel. People didn't use their homes like ATMs, end quote. Texas still was hit by the recession. Annual permits for single-family homes declined 59% from their 2005 peak to 2010. But that's less than the nation's 73% plunge, according to Texas A&M. Similarly, employment fell 4% in the downturn. The USA's overall drop was 6.3%. Texas has recovered 380,000 jobs since its December 2009 low and is now just 54,000 shy of its 10.6 million peak. 4. Population growth. Texas's population grew by 4.3 million, or 21%, during the past decade, more than twice the national pace. About half the total was because of births, but Texas also gained 849,000 residents via state-to-state migration, second only to Florida. Texas thus benefits from a virtuous cycle. More people are moving there for work, generating consumer demand that creates still more jobs. That expanded the workforce, keeping the unemployment rate at 8.2%, ranked just 26th in the nation, despite the strong payroll advances. One recent arrival is Eif Oyedokun, 26, who this month moved to the Austin area from Philadelphia, where he worked as a high school counselor. He moved to be closer to his family. Within 2 weeks, he had a job as a rehabilitation specialist for a growing outpatient facility for the mentally ill. Quote, I was very surprised, he says, with how the economy is now. I figured 3, 4, 5 months to find a job, end quote. Hunting for possible relocations. Companies are also feeling the pull. Corporate giants include Fluor, Toyota, and Medtronic recently moved headquarters or operations to Texas, and eBay, AT&T, Samsung, and Cirrus Logic have expanded there. Samsung added about 700 jobs in Austin since last year, enlarging a plant that makes chips for smartphones. Area business leaders, meanwhile, have aggressively courted out-of-state companies. The Dallas Regional Chamber this month sent a letter to 50 Illinois corporations urging them to consider a move to Texas. The mailing includes a side-by-side comparison of the two states that notes Illinois recently raised corporate and personal income taxes and highlights Texas's lower housing, labor, and other expenses. Quote, states with heavy-duty business taxes, personal taxes, or regulatory mindsets define themselves as our targets, end quote, says Chamber CEO Jim Oberwetter. That's just where we go hunting. Texas has particularly tried to lure high-tech California companies to lower-cost technology corridors in Austin, Dallas, and San Antonio. Medtronic, the Minneapolis-based medical device giant, has moved customer support for its diabetes unit from the Los Angeles area to San Antonio in the past 22 months, creating 750 jobs in Texas. Jeff Ruiz, head of Medtronic's Texas operation, says the company was drawn by labor costs that are significantly lower than those in Los Angeles and a large, high-quality workforce. Ruiz also points to more affordable real estate and the lack of a state corporate tax, though he says the latter was a minor factor. The company, which also received $14 million in incentives from the state, a figure Ruiz says was comparable with other offers, chose San Antonio from among more than 900 U.S. cities it evaluated. For some, the benefits are more basic. Marketing firm Red Ventures this year opened San Antonio office that's expected to grow to 250 employees from 60 by year's end, says spokeswoman Kylie Craig. Besides the region's ample talent pool, other draws were the city's nonstop flights to Red Venture's other offices in Miami and Charlotte, and its 7.3% unemployment rate. In cities with high jobless rates, quote, we're having to sift through many unqualified applicants, end quote. Then there's Texas's laid-back lifestyle and lower cost assets that prompted Vermilion, a startup developer of blood tests with 29 employees, to move from Fremont, California to Austin about a year ago. Quote, we found it very difficult to recruit people into California because of the cost of living, traffic, and congestion, said CEO Gail Page. The corporate relocations and expansions are having a ripple effect on restaurants, hospitals, and other service businesses. Winstead, a Dallas law firm with about 270 lawyers statewide, has added 50 since last year to handle the extra workload from such firms as Comerica Bank that moved to Texas the past few years, said Mike Baggett, Winstead's chairman emeritus. And after cutting staff in 2009 and 2010, DeMontrod Automotive in Houston has hired about 20 employees the past few months in response to a 20% jump in revenue, says owner George DeMontrod. Houston lost 120,000 jobs in the recession, but has gained about 50,000 in the last 7 months. Quote, I think people who have held off and not purchased large ticket items because of uncertainty are a little bit more ready to do it, DeMontrod says.
Obama, Boehner take cases to nation. Tax hikes off the table in House, Senate plans. After a weekend of failed talks punctuated by walkouts and worries of a downgrading of U.S. debt, both sides in the showdown over the debt ceiling retreated into their own corners Monday and emerged with two competing plans. One key difference, the size of the debt limit increase. House Republicans want an increase of $1 trillion, enough to last about 6 months, with future increases tied to finding more cuts and a House and Senate vote on a balanced budget amendment. The Senate wants $2.4 trillion, enough to get through the 2012 election. Based on what we've seen these past few weeks, we know what to expect 6 months from now, Obama said during a primetime address to the nation, calling on Americans to urge Congress to compromise. House Speaker John Boehner said he tried to work with Obama, but the president would not take yes for an answer. The sad truth is that the president wanted a blank check 6 months ago, and he wants a blank check today, Boehner said. With a House vote scheduled for Wednesday on the Boehner plan, and no timetable in the slower-paced Senate, few days would be left to reconcile the two before the government faces the prospect of default. But there is movement. Both plans take tax hikes off the table, something Democrats had insisted upon as a part of a grand deficit reduction deal. Republicans have also softened their demand to make an increase in the debt limit subject to an immediate vote on a balanced budget amendment. Both sides have settled on an immediate vote on at least $1.2 trillion in spending cuts. They've also agreed there should be a process to propose future cuts and give them an up or down vote. The House Republican plan is a modified version of the bill passed by the House but rejected by the Senate last week. The vote on a balanced budget amendment would be delayed, and many of the spending cuts would be up to a congressional commission. A number of conservatives said they won't support anything short of the original House position. Washington wants a deal. Americans want a solution, said Representative Jim Jordan, Republican of Ohio. The Senate plan, by Majority Leader Harry Reid, Democrat of Nevada, proposes $2.7 trillion in cuts over 10 years, with no reductions in entitlement benefits such as Social Security or Medicare. Reid said it also meets two Republican demands, no tax increase and spending cuts at least as large as the debt limit increase.
Okay, now another short article from the front section. Experts attack DNA evidence in Knox case. This is Perugia, Italy. The investigators who collected the genetic evidence used to convict American student Amanda Knox of murder in Italy made a series of glaring errors, including using a dirty glove and not wearing caps, two independent forensic experts said Monday. The experts had been appointed by an Italian appeals court to review the DNA evidence used in Knox's trial, including some found on a kitchen knife believed to be the murder weapon and some found on the clasp of the victim's bra. That evidence played a crucial role in securing convictions of Knox and co-defendants Raffaella Solitetti and the 2007 murder of Meredith Kircher, 21, a Briton who shared an apartment with Knox while they were exchange students in Perugia. Knox, 24, and Solicetia, 27, have denied wrongdoing and have appealed their convictions. Independent experts, both from La Sapienza University in Rome, told the appeals court that the collection of evidence fell below international standards and may have resulted in contamination. Stefanos Conti cited dozens of examples of forensic police entering the crime scene or coming into contact with objects that were not wearing protective clothing, such as masks or hair caps. The experts will be cross-examined in the next hearing, scheduled for Saturday. That will be the last hearing before the summer break.
Veterans of recent wars struggle for shelter. Since 2006, risk of homelessness explodes, VA says. More than 10,000 Iraq and Afghanistan veterans are homeless or in programs aimed at keeping them off the streets, a number that has doubled three times since 2006, according to figures released by the Department of Veterans Affairs. The rise comes at a time when the total number of homeless veterans has declined from a peak of about 400,000 in 2004 to 135,000 today. We're seeing more and more Iraq and Afghanistan veterans, said Richard Thomas, a Volunteers of America case manager at a shelter in Los Angeles. It's just a bad time for them to return now and get out of the military. The VA blames the rise on a poor economy and the nature of the current wars, where a limited number of troops serve multiple deployments. The result is a group of homeless veterans where 70% have a history of combat exposure with its psychological effects, says Pete Daugherty, a senior policy advisor on homelessness in the VA. Among all homeless veterans, perhaps 20% to 33% were in combat, he says. LaShawna Perry, a former Army mechanic who served in Iraq and Afghanistan, was homeless for more than a year after leaving the military. She rented an apartment last year with a federal voucher. Some soldiers still have issues that they're dealing from what they've seen, what they've experienced, she says. Some think there's nothing wrong with me. They can deal with it on their own until it gets out of control. As of May, there were 10,476 Iraq and Afghanistan veterans either living on the streets in temporary housing or receiving federal vouchers to help pay rent for an apartment. About 13% are women, the VA says. The spike in Iraq and Afghanistan veterans seeking shelter comes at a time when the government and nonprofit groups are pouring more resources than ever into fighting veteran homelessness. The VA and the Department of Housing and Urban Development are spending $46.2 million to expand the voucher program. The VA is set to announce today that nearly $60 million will fund a program of grants to veterans with families who are homeless or at risk of losing their homes. There are places to turn to for help that did not exist before, says John Driscoll, president and chief executive officer of the National Coalition for Homeless Veterans. He said more than 2,400 nonprofit organizations across the country now have homeless veteran programs.
Norwegians spill sorrow in streets. Man admits to killing 76, but not terror. There is a picture accompanying this article and captioned "Bearing Roses, Unbearable Grief." A young couple are among the estimated 100,000 people who gathered Monday in downtown Oslo for a vigil following Friday's twin terror attacks. there's the couple in the foreground, but against the background are the picture is filled with people, many carrying symbolic red roses and some displaying the Norwegian flag. Tens of thousands of Norwegians filled the streets and laid bouquets Monday near bombed-out buildings that were destroyed by a man who says he blew them up and massacred dozens of people at a summer camp to stop Muslim immigration. Crowds came out in a handful of cities to express grief and sympathy with the victims of Friday's terror attacks, which killed 68 people, including many teenagers on a political youth retreat. An additional 8 people died in the bombings of government offices. Quote, "It was touching to see all of those enormous numbers of people," said Morten Lund Matheson, a partner at Norwegian law firm Wikborg Rein, whose offices overlook the Oslo City Hall. Quote, "I was a bit moved. There were people putting flowers all the time," end quote. Anders Behring Breivik pleaded not guilty to charges of terrorism in court Monday, but the judge at the closed hearing said Breivik admitted he shot the people at the retreat and planted explosives downtown. Judge Jim Hegger ordered Breivik held for 8 weeks, including 4 in isolation. If convicted, he faces 21 years in prison. Hegger said Breivik told the court that 2 other groups of allies are already to join to his murderous campaign. Norway's police says Breivik acted alone, despite his claims in a 1,500-plus page manifesto that he belonged to a modern group of crusaders. The death toll of 76 people was lower than the original estimate of 93 killed. The reduction adds to a list of police missteps. They took 90 minutes to arrive at the island from the first shot, and people there who called emergency services have been reported being told by operators to stay off the lines unless they were calling about the Oslo bombings. Police revealed Monday that its entire Oslo helicopter crew was on vacation the day of the attack. The head of the World Council of Churches, a group that includes many Christian faiths, assailed Breivik for citing Christianity as a justification for his attack. Quote, "It is important to say to all Muslims, wherever they are, in Europe or elsewhere in the world, that these actions in no way can express what is our Christian faith and our Christian values," said the Reverend Olav Fisk Tevik. "It is blasphemous to make that kind of connection." The call for a Rose March in Oslo came from an ordinary Norwegian who orchestrated a Facebook campaign that drew 150,000 people to the streets. People laid wreaths of flowers around town, twining roses around steel fences. Quote, "With torches and roses, we give the world a message," says Jens Stoltenberg, Norway's prime minister, whose office was destroyed in the blast. "We will not let the fear break us. With the strongest of all weapons, the free word and democracy, we stake our course for Norway." Breivik's father said he was ashamed by his son and wished he had committed suicide. Quote, "I don't feel like his father," said Jens David Breivik, a former diplomat who lives in France and was divorced from Breivik's mother in 1980. He told the Swedish newspaper Expressen that he and his son have had virtually no contact since 1995, when Anders was 16, except for a bland phone call 10 years ago. Quote, "I will have to live with this shame for the rest of my life," he said.
Oil spill victims weary of wait. A year after the Gulf disaster, many feel BP compensation slow and arbitrary. Robert Campo once believed the TV commercials by oil giant BP that promised to make it right and compensate those along the Gulf Coast who lost work during last year's disastrous oil spill. More than a year after the spill ruined his oyster beds, however, Campo is still waiting for what he believes is full payment. The $20 billion fund created by BP to compensate those ruined by the spill has offered him less than one-third of what he requested. He's still waiting to hear why. I'm not looking for a handout. I'm just looking for them to make right what they did wrong, said Campo, an oyster fisherman from St. Bernard Parish, Louisiana. It's taken way too long. Campo joins a chorus of local fishermen, seafood processors, hoteliers, and others who say that nearly a year since it opened its doors, the Gulf Coast Claims Facilities that administers the BP fund has not moved fast enough to pay those hurt most by the spill. Last week, Attorney General Eric Holder ordered an independent audit of the fund. Kenneth Feinberg, the fund's administrator, has agreed to the audit scheduled for sometime this year. The Gulf Coast Claims Facility has paid nearly $5 billion in claims to about 200,000 claimants, one of the largest payout efforts in U.S. history, according to the facility. The fund was started in the wake of the explosions and sinking of the Deepwater Horizon rig in April 2010, which killed 11 workers and unleashed more than 170 million gallons of crude into the Gulf. BP leased the rig and assumed most of the responsibility for its aftermath. Local officials and some claimants say the facility has improved in recent months after earlier complaints of taking too long to process claims and not clearly explaining why some were rejected. Customer service at the facility's Gulf Coast offices, for example, has improved, and claimants are at least getting answers on the status of their claims, says Tony Kennan, mayor of Orange Beach, Alabama, an early critic of Feinberg and the fund. Some aspects of the program have gotten better, Kennan says. We still don't feel like we're where we should be, but I do appreciate Feinberg moving in our direction. Critics of the facility say the process still appears bogged down and random. Some boat deckhands are getting paid full compensation, while business owners with full documentation are receiving only a percentage of their losses. George Barish, a Louisiana shrimper and president of the United Commercial Fishermen's Alliance, says he has produced tax documents and other receipts showing he lost $200,000 last year. The facility offered him $25,000. Every week, facility workers ask him for more documentation, Barish says. It's a game, he says. The game is starve these poor fishermen out until they're ready to take whatever's offered. The bays he shrimps in still deliver fat nets full of brown shrimp, but dock prices have dropped since the spill because of public unease about the safety of Gulf seafood, he says. Campo says he has filed documents with the fund showing he harvested $309,000 worth of oysters in 2008 and $252,000 in 2009. The BP fund's offer for last year's losses, $41,400. One of his deckhands received $75,000, while another was paid $49,000, both more than his payout, even though he owns the boat. It's a joke, says Campo, a third-generation oyster man. You have this big question mark hanging over your head. You don't know what's going to happen to this industry. Feinberg says he tweaked the process after fielding repeated complaints from locals, including adding 700 workers to speed up the process. The fund is also allowing oyster harvesters to get a bigger payment because the future of some oyster beds is in question, he says. He says he welcomes an independent audit as long as it doesn't slow down the process. It's not perfect. People will complain, Feinberg says, but I think the program has worked as intended. But it's still not fast enough or transparent enough, Mississippi Attorney General Jim Hood says. Hood filed a federal lawsuit earlier this month asking a judge to allow his office to sift through Feinberg's files. To keep dragging them out is just frustrating, Hood says. There has to be a third-party set of eyes to look over this process at some point. Feinberg says his workers must carefully review documents to spot fraudulent or invalid claims. His workers have received nearly 1 million claims from all 50 states in Canada and Mexico, ranging from veterinarians to chiropractors to Las Vegas restaurants, all purporting damage from the spill, he says. One business asked for $20 billion, the entire amount of the fund. Given the challenges, Feinberg says he's happy with the pace of payouts. Most of the fund could be spent by the time his contract with BP expires in August 2013, he says.
And now we have an opinion from the forum page. This is from syndicated talk radio host Michael Medved, author of The Five Big Lies About American Business, who is a member of USA Today's Board of Contributors. The title, Punishing the Rich, Impractical, Unethical. It's easy politically to vilify those with the most money, but it's neither fair nor good for the country. Beyond the dueling soundbites at apoplectic rhetoric of Washington's increasingly desperate battles of the budget, President Obama enjoys an automatic advantage with his relentless cause to tax the rich. These demands resonate with American instincts to endorse the underdog while cutting the privileged and powerful down to size. Republicans may insist with flawless logic that seizing resources from business people does nothing to encourage them to expand, invest, or create jobs. Conservatives also cite the latest IRS figures, showing top earners already paying more than their fair share. The top 5% earn 35% of adjusted gross income, but pay 59% of all income taxes. What's more, the share of the overall burden shouldered by this group has risen sharply, not declined, since controversial Bush tax cuts of 2001-2003. In the arena of public opinion, however, arguments must appeal to emotion, as well as evidence and common sense. It is not enough to demonstrate that attacking the rich is misguided in practice. It is also essential to show that it's wrong as a matter of principle. What's best for America? The only way to overcome populist preference for the people over the powerful is through impassioned affirmation of another traditional value, that beneficial behavior deserves more encouragement than a destructive course of action. Americans may not favor rich over poor, but they certainly don't prefer the irresponsible to the productive. When you consider people who've created wealth and built beautiful lives for their families, it's healthy to want to emulate them, but it is profoundly unhealthy to want to annihilate them. After all, the rich generally do what we want all Americans to do: work hard, earn money, pay taxes, and spend or invest what's left. Industrious pursuit of profit remains the best way to stimulate prosperity, and most people understand that we should welcome, not discourage, this pattern. Poor people, on the other hand, need to change, and they know it. No one wants to remain dependent or destitute, or to pass on that condition to future generations. But to live middle-class lives, the underclass needs to learn middle-class habits, and to leave behind dysfunctional values that characterize persistent pockets of poverty. Even the most committed free marketers admit this process often requires outside help to master new skills, provide better schools, and build safer neighborhoods. But such help only benefits the poor when it leads them to alter the conduct that has trapped them in indigence in the first place. Government policies on taxes and spending inevitably impacts private decisions for better and for worse. We tax tobacco heavily, which has helped to dramatically reduce smoking rates. At the same time, we subsidize loans and grants to promote college education, and this assistance helped triple the percentage of young people pursuing higher education. In that context, it makes no sense to penalize successful people with higher tax rates. Their effort and imagination add jobs and growth while subtracting nothing from society at large.
Extreme weather has its sunny side. Snowpack rain douse drought in West and restore habitats. If you're struggling to stay cool this long, hot summer, this may be hard to believe. This year's run of extreme weather conditions, which has brought everything from a heat wave to flooding along the Mississippi River to drought and wildfire in Arizona and record snow in the Midwest and Northeast, also has produced some positive results. Rain and snow has boosted the water supplies for farms and cities and ended the drought in California. The same conditions have improved habitat for desert wildlife and reduced wildfire risk in many areas of the West. More than 60 feet of snow fell in the Sierra Nevada over the winter and spring, second only to the winter of 1950-1951, according to the California Department of Transportation. That snow brought enough water to prompt Governor Jerry Brown in late May to lift a statewide drought declaration ordered in 2008. It was great. It was one of the big ones, said Maury Ruse, chief hydrologist of the California Department of Water Resources, of the improvement in water supplies resulting from the weather last spring and winter. All of the states west of the Rockies are drought-free, according to the most recent U.S. Drought Monitor. It makes a real difference, said Paul Wenger, who grows almonds and walnuts in Modesto, California. This year was fantastic, he said. Over the last 4 or 5 years, we've seen a lot of fields go back to tumbleweeds. Elsewhere, at the Stillwater National Wildlife Refuge in Nevada, water draining from a record-setting mountain snowpack has transformed this desert oasis, expanding marshes now teeming with birds and wildlife and creating the largest wetlands in the past 5 years, biologist Bill Henry said. More than 20,000 acres are flooded, providing habitats for waterfowl and other wildlife. The risk to forests across much of the northern Rockies, Pacific Northwest, and northern California has been substantially reduced by snowpack and a cooler-than-average spring, said Don Smurthwaite of the National Interagency Fire Center in Boise. The heat wave is expected to continue in the southern plains and is forecast to spread toward the eastern seaboard, according to Weather Channel meteorologist Mark Ressler.
And now we'll go to Moneyline cover story. Only one deadly strain of E. coli is illegal. Pushes on to outlaw the other lethal bugs. The food safety world knows there's a half dozen or more lethal forms of E. coli ending up in our meat or our leafy greens that are so virulent they can send people to the hospital and even kill them. But in the United States, only one, the E. coli, 0157H7, is officially termed an adulterant, meaning any raw ground raw beef that tests positive for it cannot be sold for human consumption. There's no requirement that companies test for the other lethal strains, and it is not illegal for them to be in the food. And that, says a growing chorus of lawmakers, food safety, and consumer advocates, needs to change. But attempts by these legislators and interest groups to broaden the types of E. coli strains that are specifically subject to federal regulation so far haven't succeeded. Quote, "We cannot afford to wait for a tragic outbreak before taking action," Representative Rosa DeLauro, Democrat, Connecticut, said earlier this month in a letter to the Secretary of Agriculture. In the absence of specific federal oversight, however, some companies have begun their own testing for these pathogens to protect consumers and their own bottom line. First out of the chute was Costco, which began testing its ground beef 2 months ago. Beef Products, Inc., the nation's largest supplier of lean beef, began testing on July 18th. There's also movement in the world of produce and leafy greens, where multiple producers and retailers have been testing for E. coli 0157H7 since the spinach outbreak that almost wiped out the leafy green vegetable market in 2006. In the past few months, newly available tests have made it possible to check for a broader number of microbes, and they now include the harmful group of E. coli strains beyond 0157H7. This group is known as the Big Six. The reason these bugs aren't currently regulated are a mix of politics, money, and plain biology. The bacteria are constantly evolving and turning up in newer and nastier forms, making writing rules out about them a bit of a nightmare. For example, the German E. coli variant that sickened more than 4,000 people in Europe and killed 50 of them, including one Arizona resident who traveled to Germany, this strain wasn't known before the spring. It's only the latest in the list of E. coli types that can get into food and kill people. But why only O157H7? There are literally thousands of forms of E. coli that live harmlessly in the guts of mammals. But in 1993, the E. coli O157H7 variant, which had been seen only a few times before, caused an outbreak linked to undercooked hamburgers at Jack in the Box restaurants on the West Coast that killed 4 children and sickened more than 700. The USDA decided to single out E. coli O157H7 because it was especially virulent and seemed to cause illness when present even in very small amounts in hamburger. It can cause abdominal pain, bloody diarrhea, kidney failure, and death. So in 1994, the Department of Agriculture, which oversees meat safety, declared E. coli O157H7 in ground beef was an adulterant. Beef producers have to have systems in place to eliminate it and cook, treat, or destroy any product that contains it. That's a different stance than the one taken by the Food and Drug Administration, which pretty much oversees all foods but meat. On July 3rd, FDA, in the midst of the German E. coli outbreak, made a low-key statement that any strain of E. coli that makes humans actively ill was illegal, but it didn't go so far as to call them an adulterant, but made clear they weren't allowed in any food that the agency oversaw, which is most ready-to-eat products. The catch is that FDA doesn't test products, so there's no way to know when a product is contaminated. The Food Safety Modernization Act, which began to go into effect later this year, will require companies to show they're putting safeguards in place, but doesn't specifically mention these pathogens. If this all seems a little confusing, it is. Food safety advocates want both the USDA and the FDA to agree that these most common forms of E. coli, known to harm humans, should be labeled as adulterants. But why is there a pushback against testing? One reason is cost, said Donnelly. Mandatory testing costs money. So does correcting a problem if one is found. In meat, contaminated products can be cooked and sold, but it's worth a lot less than fresh meat, Donnelly says. That's why FDA and USDA need to step in. Quote, we're counting on these agencies to put the public's health and safety first, and it can't be concerned about the industry's bottom line.
Wall Street sees 3 debt limit scenarios. Markets are banking on a no-default deal. With the clock ticking and no deal yet from Congress on solving the nation's debt woes, Wall Street is handicapping how stocks might react depending on how the stalemate is resolved. Politicians, central bankers, and investors have warned that catastrophic harm to markets and the economy will occur if Congress doesn't raise the debt ceiling by August 2nd and the nation defaults on its debts. Yet stocks have not suffered the steep drop that some predicted. The Dow is down just 1.7% from its 2011 high, even after Monday's 88-point drop to 12,593. Wall Street is betting that lawmakers will come to an agreement in time, mainly to protect their political careers and avoid being blamed for causing the first ever default in U.S. history. The markets are pricing in a strong likelihood of no default, said Don Luskin, chief investment officer at Trend Micro. Monday, both parties submitted new plans to end the logjam, but still didn't seal a deal. Here is how stocks might fare under 3 scenarios. Scenario 1. In this bullish case, Congress extends the debt ceiling and also comes up with budget cuts big enough to please credit rating agencies, which are threatening to downsize U.S. debt if a credible plan does not materialize. The upshot? The country would not default, nor would it lose its gold-plated AAA credit status. In that case, stocks would likely make a run at new bull market highs, Luskin said. The Dow is less than 218 points below its April 29th high. Scenario 2. Congress extends the debt ceiling, but it can't pass a sizable enough plan to address the long-term deficit problem, prompting the rating agencies to downgrade U.S. debt. The ratings drop could spook investors, but the downside will be limited to around 10%, says Jason Pride, director of investment strategy at Glenmead. Stock losses will be contained because borrowing rates won't jump too much, and the credit agencies have lost some clout due to their failure to alert investors about risky mortgages in the financial crisis. Scenario 3. In this worst-case outcome, dubbed a low-probability event, Congress fails to raise the debt ceiling or agree on a deficit-cutting roadmap. The U.S. would default on its debts and lose its AAA rating. Economists say it would cause a recession and market chaos. A default is much more harmful than a downgrade, says David Kelly, market strategist at J.P. Morgan Funds. A credit downgrade can be reversed, but a default is a stain on your reputation forever. Don't forget that when the market thinks something can't happen, and it does, look out below, Luskin says.
And now, also from Moneyline, it's Your Money column, which appears every Tuesday, and it's by Sandra Block. The title, Every Credit Score is Not Created the Same, Even When You Pay for It. If you spent any time on the internet, you've probably seen ads for free credit scores. They usually appear alongside ads promising to make your belly fat disappear. There are two problems with these promotions. First, you usually have to sign up for credit monitoring, identity theft protection, or some other credit service to get your credit score. These products cost anywhere from $15 to $18 a month. But even more troubling, these scores could give you a distorted view of your credit standing, according to a report from the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. That's because these credit scores usually aren't the same scores lenders use when they consider your application for a loan, the CFPB said. Credit scores marketed to consumers who ordered their credit reports from annualcreditreport.com could also mislead consumers, the report said. While consumers are often reminded of the importance of a good credit score, there are lots of different credit scores circulating in the marketplace. Some credit scores sold to consumers by the big three credit bureaus, TransUnion, Equifax, and Experian, are quote-unquote educational scores that aren't used by the lenders, the CFPB says. The score you buy may be based on different information than the one used to consider your application for a car loan or home mortgage. Another possibility, the information used to calculate your score could change between the time you buy a score and the time you apply for a loan. The discrepancy isn't a problem for consumers with stellar credit, says John Alzheimer, president of consumer education for SmartCredit.com. Quote, if you've got fantastic credit, you're going to have a fantastic score, regardless of what score is being used, he says. Similarly, if your score is abysmal, there's not going to be much difference between the score you buy and the one the lenders see. Most consumers, though, fall between those two extremes, Alzheimer says. Here's how differences between the scores you have and the ones your lenders use could cost you money. For example, if the score leads you to believe your credit is worse than it is, you could end up settling for higher interest rates than you're eligible for, or decide not to apply for credit at all. Second, if the score causes you to feel overconfident about your credit, You could waste time and money applying for loans that won't be approved. You could even end up in worse shape because when you apply for a loan, inquiries from creditors show up on your credit report. Multiple inquiries could dent your score. Knowing the score. Fortunately, starting this month, millions of consumers will get a look at the credit scores lenders use. A provision of the financial reform bill that took effect Thursday requires lenders to provide you with a free copy of your credit score whenever they turn you down for a loan or approve a loan with a higher interest rate than the one offered to their best consumers. Lenders must give you the score used to make a determination on your loan, not a generic or educational version. They're also required to explain the factors that affected your score and show you where it falls on the range of possible credit scores. This is useful information, but it won't help consumers who want to know where they stand before they apply for a loan. How to get a more accurate idea of what your lenders will see? 1. Order your free credit reports. While scores differ, they all are based on information from your credit reports. So at the very least, you should check your credit reports to make sure the information in them is accurate. You can get an annual copy of each of your credit reports from the 3 credit bureaus at annualcreditreport.com. Information on your credit report can affect everything from your car insurance premiums to whether you get a job. Only 38% of consumers have obtained a copy of their credit report, according to the National Bureau of Economic Research. 2. If you decide to buy a score, buy a FICO score. That's FICO, FICO. There are lots of credit scores out there, but the FICO score is the one the vast majority of lenders use. You can purchase a FICO score based on your TransUnion and Equifax credit reports for $19.95 each at myfico.com. FICO stores based on Experian credit reports are not available to consumers. Lastly, use free scores to give you a general idea of where you stand. Websites Credit Karma, Quizzle, Credit Sesame, and Credit.com provide free, no-obligation credit profiles. This isn't the same as a FICO score, but you'll get a general idea of whether you're an excellent, average, or poor credit risk.
And now for sports. Deal done, NFL on fast track. Teams enter hurry-up mode on transactions, free agency. Football is coming back in a blur, with the NFL reopening its doors today after the longest work stoppage in league history was supplanted by the longest sports labor deal ever. There is no such thing as easing back. Less than 48 hours after NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell and NFL Players Association Executive Director DeMaurice Smith stood on a sidewalk outside union headquarters in Washington and announced agreement on a 10-year labor pact, the first 10 NFL training camps will open Wednesday. Don't have enough players to stock the expanded 90-man training camp roster yet? No problem. Rookies can be signed today, and free agency begins Friday. Once it opens up, every day that goes by will be like a month, Miami Dolphins general manager Jeff Ireland says. NFL executives, coaches, players, and agents are bracing for the blizzard of activity that will christen the league's comeback from its 136-day lockout. In a matter of days, each team will be forced to execute dozens of personnel moves that typically play out over several months during the offseason. Besides competing to lure players from a supersized free agent market and signing draft picks, teams must try to re-sign some of their own targeted free agents, restructure contracts, part ways with some veterans, and vie for undrafted rookies, all under the umbrella of a salary cap that returns for 2011 at $120,375,000. In 2009, the last year cap was implemented, the figure was $123 million. This will be pretty unique, Indianapolis Colts president Bill Polian says. But you've got to get it done. That's the bottom line. Polian, whose team will reopen under a cloud of uncertainty regarding the health of franchise quarterback Peyton Manning as he rehabilitates from neck surgery, has 63 players signed under contract and must account for 27 slots for a full roster. Some of the spots, including Manning, who was franchise-tagged, and the five draft picks, reduced the positions available. Other teams will be harder-pressed. An analysis of team rosters reveals six teams with fewer than 50 players signed, with the Arizona Cardinals, 41, Baltimore Ravens at 45, San Diego Chargers at 45, at the low end. Fans starved for activity for months won't mind the rush. Team decision-makers, caught in the middle of the sometimes contentious negotiations between owners and players, probably prefer the scramble to the alternative of a longer league shutdown. After a seminar Friday in Atlanta where nearly 150 team executives were briefed on the changes linked to the new labor deal, including a rookie salary cap of about $170 million league-wide, which is 4.5% of the overall cap, several GMs talked of approaching the new year with methods similarly used under normal off-season circumstances. In other words, they have targeted priorities and ranked players in various categories, typical of how teams align players on their draft boards. "I've been staring at the board but not able to move any cards," Ireland said. That will change in a hurry, underscored by a crop of unrestricted free agents headlined by Oakland Raiders All-Pro cornerback Nnamdi Asamugha that might be the deepest in league history. The market, including 442 unrestricted free agents, is bolstered by the presence of many fifth- and sixth-year players who were kept off the market last year. In 2009, rules for an uncapped year required six accrued seasons rather than four for unrestricted status. "Free agency is going to be nothing like we've ever seen before," Cardinals wide receiver Larry Fitzgerald says. "You'll have 3 or 4 days to sign free agents to your team. That's going to be crazy." Already, as the league released its official list of free agents Monday night, speculation swirled about the possible destinations for prize catches. "The start of free agency is always frenetic," Atlanta Falcons president Rich McKay says. "It's always a crazy time. It's always 48 hours of a different mindset. This will be different than any of the others." With the extensive roster shuffling looming and the typical musical chairs effect of the market, when teams might not pursue some players until other options are exhausted, it's possible that some key free agents might not join their teams until a couple weeks into training camp. "This will be a really stressful time for coaches," McKay says. "We, as club people, have to be mindful of that because teams will be built as we're actually going into the preseason. Coaches and GMs aren't the only ones whose limits will be tested. As players begin filling into camps after not having been seen for months in many cases, team doctors and trainers will be pressed to conduct physicals and update rehabilitation of previous injuries. You want to see if the players spend their time wisely over the past few months," Ireland said. "Let's hope they're in shape."
And now, tonight's announcements. We have three. First, on Friday, July 28th, bingo and pizza at the JC Club Room from 7 to 8:45. $8. It's $5 registration and $3 transportation. B9, N37, 063, bingo. Braille and large print cards are available. There will be a 2-card limit per person, pizza and drinks provided, no age requirements, and door-to-door transportation is available. If you're interested, you may call Raleigh Parks and Recreation Department, Tara Lewis, at 919-807-5403, or you may email at vipstaff@raleighnc.gov. Our next announcement, summer movies with audio descriptions for free. For over a dozen years, the Joseph M. Bryan Jr. Theater in the Museum Park has made the North Carolina Museum of Art a favorite destination for lovers of great music and movies, as well as fine art and sculpture. Experience the best in the arts in an open-air theater, a work of art in itself. This summer schedule includes some movies with audio description And the museum is offering pairs of free tickets to users of the audio description service. The movies are The King's Speech, Saturday, July 30th, 9 p.m. I normally don't editorialize, but this was a really good film, and I think it could be enjoyed very much from an audio description point of view. I highly recommend it. The next film is The Social Network, Friday, August 19th at 8:30 p.m. If either of these interests you, call George Holt at 919-664-6745 and tell him you want a pair of these tickets. That's George Holt, and the number is 919-664-6745. Again, 919-664-6745. And you are listening to the Triangle Radio Reading Service, connecting people who are blind and print impaired to each other, their communities, and families by delivering news, information, and entertainment using the latest audio technology. You can hear the TRRS broadcast via Raleigh Community Television on Time Warner Cable, Channel 22 in Raleigh. The broadcasts are also available on Channel 11 in Cary, Garner, and Apex, and on Cable Channel 18 in Hillsboro. TRRS also streams its programs to the web. You can listen at triangleReadingService.org on your computer by going to the website and clicking on the Listen Now line in the right-hand navigation bar. TRRS also provides podcasts of 30 magazines and other information programs following the initial broadcast of them on our airwaves. Again, go to the TRRS website, TriangleReadingService.org, and click on the podcast line in the right-hand navigation bar. If you would like more information about your Triangle Radio Reading Service, please call 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138.
And back to sports. Showdown winners and losers. Biggest benefits could go to fans. Now that things appear to be settled, USA Today takes a look at the winners and losers after the NFL labor face-off. The winners, the fans. Many fretted over the tumultuous nature of the collective bargaining negotiations. Others were in wake-me-up-when-it's-over mode. Well, it's finally over after 136 days with the regular season spared any disruption, which is what many who love the NFL and many in fantasy leagues say they really wanted. Top-tier free agents. Nnamdi Asamugha, Santonio Holmes, D'Angelo Williams et al. Should all cash in nicely as teams compete for their services in the coming days. And with clubs mandated to spend most of their $120 million salary cap allotment, some massive paydays could be in the offing. Star players with long-term contracts. Don't be fooled. Many probably enjoyed the extra family time, vacation windows, and added golf course rounds as they awaited the lockout's outcome with a fair amount of security. Veteran teams. Continuity could pay off more than ever for stable franchises such as the Baltimore Ravens, the Green Bay Packers, Indianapolis Colts, the New England Patriots, the New York Jets, Philadelphia Eagles, and Pittsburgh Steelers. Their coaching staffs and systems have been in place for years, and these largely seasoned teams won't be hurt as much as the ones who need more hitting and technique work and live repetition in newly regulated practices. NFL employees. Many non-players around the league had to endure pay cuts, furloughs, and the like. But most will recoup their losses. According to ESPN, the Jets reimbursed their staffers before the lockout officially ended Monday. And those who count on jobs revolving around NFL Sundays won't be left out in the cold. The people of Canton, Ohio, who lost the Hall of Fame game, might feel very differently. Injured players. They got to rest their bodies and focus on their rehabs without fear of being cut or feeling the need to push themselves too early. And the losers, Injured players, on the other hand, they weren't able to enjoy the supervision of team medical personnel or the availability of team facilities. Exhibit A, Colts quarterback Peyton Manning. Commissioner Roger Goodell, he has taken a beating from players and not just James Harrison. News reporters and fans, while trying to broker a complicated deal, all while being paid a dollar for the lockout's duration. Fairly or not, Goodell largely became the face of the labor problems as he tried to negotiate a settlement that kept his 32 constituent owners, many with divergent agendas, happy, much less a players' union than repeatedly tried to show it wouldn't be bullied. New head coaches, eight of them essentially start from square one in late July rather than mid-March. Leslie Frazier, the Minnesota Vikings, Jason Garrett, the Dallas Cowboys, Hugh Jackson, Oakland Raiders, and Mike Munchak, Tennessee Titans, are at least familiar with their teams after serving on staff before their promotions. John Fox, Denver Broncos, Jim Harbaugh of the San Francisco 49ers, Ron Rivera of the Carolina Panthers, and Pat Shurmur of the Cleveland Browns will have a lot more ground to cover as they try to restore luster to some of the prouder franchises in the league. Unhappy veteran quarterbacks Donovan McNabb, Carson Palmer, and Vince Young have all been successful NFL starting quarterbacks to varying degrees, but they're all stuck in untenable situations that could not be resolved during the lockout. They could be hard-pressed to make an impact in 2011, especially if the Bengals force Palmer to follow through on his threat to retire, as they hope to land in greener pastures. Drafted rookies from Carolina quarterback Cam Newton, the top pick of the 2011 draft, to Houston Texans pass rusher Cheetah Azeguo, Mr. Irrelevant at pick number 254. None of the incoming players has been able to make an on-field impression on his coaches, learn his playbook, or realize a fiscal windfall yet. Newton and the high-end first-rounders won't be compensated like their predecessors. Newton could earn at least $22.03 million over his first four seasons, and the Panthers have an option worth approximately $14.3 million for Newton's fifth year, according to the NFLPA. By comparison, previous top pick Sam Bradford was guaranteed $50 million by the St. Louis Rams in 2010 and can earn up to $78 million over his six-year pact. Undrafted rookies, the Mark Herzlicks of the world, might really pay after failing to land with a team in April's draft. Some of these players will be scooped up this week, but they could be even more hamstrung than their drafted peers as they battled for playing time and practice repetitions while trying to absorb sophisticated playbooks. And with veterans protected by the labor settlement's new practice rules limiting contact, camp buddies might earn even fewer chances to shine. Lawyers. Whenever they're in the spotlight, as they often were, it's bad for public relations on both sides. Their fees collected, they'll now have to wait at least a decade before the next major consult.
And now, a short article. Obama honors giants. For one afternoon, the weighty issues vexing the participants in Monday's White House ceremony, the ongoing debt ceiling debate for one, and a lackluster offense for the other, were put aside as President Obama honored the San Francisco Giants for their 2010 World Season Championships. The entire Giants traveling party, including closer Brian Wilson, was dressed in a manner befitting an audience with a head of state. Wilson's jet black prospector beard and faux hawk and rooster tail hairdo were in fine form. And in fact, during that presentation, Obama did turn around and look at Brian Wilson, saying, "I do fear it," referring to the beard. But while the president checked off some of the all-star closer's ubiquitous looks, the spandex tuxedo, the sea captain costume, and the cleats with his face on it, Wilson was in the back row, decked out in a blue pinstripe suit with flag pin and light blue tie. Obama also singled out Giants ace Tim Lincecum. When Tim entered the draft 5 years ago, Obama says. 9 teams passed him over before the Giants picked him up. Nobody thought that somebody that skinny with that violent a delivery could survive without just flying apart. But now, with 2 Cy Youngs under his belt, everybody understand why he's called the freak. America's learned sometimes it's a good idea to bet on the skinny guy. So, pointing at Lincecum, Obama said, "It's you and me."
Now for the life section. More kids today living in grand families. When mom or dad can't care for their child, the parents' parents step into the breach. 4 months of an empty nest were all that Annabelle and John Baird had before their home in Highland Village, Texas, wasn't so empty anymore. But unlike many families today, it wasn't their adult children returning home or elderly parents moving in. It was their granddaughter, Katie, just 10 months old, when the Baird's son and his wife asked them to take her while they were in the midst of a divorce. She has been there ever since. Katie, now 15, calls her grandmother Mom. John died in 2007. Annabelle Baird, age 65, now lives with Katie in Richardson, a Dallas suburb. "Our son and his family were unable to care for this baby. They came to us and asked us if we would take temporary custody. We said no, but would take permanent custody and back out when they demonstrated their ability to care for this child," she says. "That never happened." The Baird's experience is like that of so many grandparents today. Although it's a family dynamic filled with complexities, more grandparents than ever are finding themselves in the throes of parenthood yet again. Census data released last month found that 3.1 million children in the USA were living without a parent in the household in 2009. Of those, 59% lived with grandparents. Grandparents step in when parents are out of the picture because of substance abuse, physical or mental illness, financial problems, incarceration, death, or more recently, military deployment and the recession. These grandparents, many of whom have planned for travel or more me time, are instead navigating the terrible twos, school, sports, and the vast cultural and technological changes, think Lady Gaga and texting, that have occurred since their own children were young. As a result of this growth, there's considerable new research about this demographic, sometimes referred to as the skip generation households or grandfamilies. "I wanted to be grandma. You know, the kids come over and you treat them special and then you turn them home to their mother or father," says Joy Sylvia, age 69, of Providence. "That's what I had planned." Instead, she ended up adopting 2 granddaughters when they were in elementary school. Now they're 12 and 15. Terribly mixed emotions. "People like me need some place they can go and be with other people who are in the same situation," she says of the support group she attends. "We tell each other stories to help us get through it. Some grandmothers are so downtrodden because this is devastating. 60 is not when you want to be taking care of kids." An analysis released last fall by the Pew Research Center found that grandparents who are primary caregivers of grandchildren are relatively young. 67% are under 60, and 13% are under 45, the 2009 data show. "I'm nowhere near as young and energetic as I was when I was raising my own children," says Diane Burke, 48, of Lacey, Washington, the mother of 8. "Sometimes it's hard to keep up with 2 toddlers." She and Dave, her husband of 9 years, took in her grandchildren in October 2008 when Joey was just over 1 month old and Alyssa was 11 months. Burke says her son, then 22, showed up at my door with the kids one night. Her 3 teens were still living at home. She has custody of her grandchildren, now 2 and 3. "My life has changed quite a bit," Burke says, "but I wouldn't trade it for the world." "Some people say your grandchildren are so blessed." "No, it's me. I'm the one who is blessed," Burke says. Donna Butts, executive director of the nonprofit Generations United, says grandparents have terribly mixed emotions about the situation they're in. "The most common feeling is one of loss," experts say. For whatever reason, they've lost their own child who is not there to parent, and they've lost their own roles. Suddenly, your independence is lost and you're dealing with the child who is also struggling with loss, says Carol Cox, a professor of social work at Fordham University in New York. There's a real sense of loss in these families. Baird says the grief was so great because her friends' relationships with their husbands and families hadn't changed. They had grandchildren. I didn't, she says. I lost a grandchild in this, and my grandchild lost her grandparents because she became our child. A lot of worries. Experts say grandparents have nagging fears and often are hypervigilant, Cox says. They don't want this child to go wrong. They worry so much about what happened to their own child. They also worry about the passing years. There's no guarantee that they're going to be there for that child, says Gregory Smith, a gerontologist and developmental psychologist at Kent State University in Ohio. Sylvia says she's making sure my insurance is paid so there is no problem if something happens to me. Carol Musel, a professor at the School of Nursing at Case Western Reserve University in Cleveland, has seen a heavy load of worries among grandparents since she's been studying since 1996. It's this magnified multi-generational parenting. They're worrying about two generations of kids. Much of the research done in the past 10 years has focused on the health and well-being of grandparents engaged in child rearing. Grandparents, in general, have more physical disability and depression than their peers not raising grandkids, said Esme Fuller Thompson, a professor of social work at the University of Toronto. She has looked at a variety of populations, and the patterns hold within each group. It seems that grandparents will step forward no matter what their personal sacrifices to take care of these children, she says. Her new research, which she'll present at a conference in November, focuses on the positives. She says grandkids make grandparents proud and create family closeness, reduce feelings of loneliness, and make them feel more youthful and re-energized. Having kids around is fun. The grandparents also spoke of having a sense of purpose and more time for their grandkids than they had for their kids. Parenting grandkids reduced stress because they knew the kids were safe in their home. Cox says that in the 150 grandparent-headed families she has studied, most are caring for more than one grandchild, and often it's an informal arrangement so the family can avoid foster care and potentially losing the child to adoption. I didn't even think about how hard it would be raising a child again, said Linda James, age 64, of Rochester, New York. My thought was, I didn't want this child to go into foster care. I didn't want this baby to lose her identity. I wanted her to be with family. That was my reason. James has cared for two grandchildren since they were less than 6 months old. They are now 21 and 23 and still live with her while both are in college. Her daughter died in 1991. Helen Fletcher, age 72, a retired federal employee in Toledo, had five grandchildren come to live with her in 2004 when her daughter, now 35, was incarcerated. At the time, the youngest was two, the oldest about 10. These children were always going to stay together, she said. I don't know anybody who would have taken five children. Even as the grandparents open their arms to grandkids, experts say there is plenty of anger at that adult child. Bert Hayslip, professor of psychology at the University of North Texas in Denton, says grandparents often speak very critically of their children, whose decisions force them to step in. Yet, of course, it's your own daughter or son. They can be pretty angry with them and still care about them. Sylvia says that she and her husband had no kid troubles until their son was 18 and got into that street scene and all that. Katie Baird, now a high school sophomore, says she started calling her grandmother Granabelle. But as I got a little older, I decided I would call her Mom because I wanted a mom.
And last, before we leave, the Et cetera Smart Insight News of the Day from Mia Salvet's time. Another addiction death comes at age 27 with Amy Winehouse joining Jimi Hendrix, Jim Morrison, Kurt Cobain, and most aptly Janis Joplin among the rock icons who died from their disorder at the same point in their young lives. You are listening to the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Judy Bobe, Mark Turner, and Laura Arwood have been reading from the USA Today. Please tune in tomorrow at 9 a.m. for our exercise program and at 9:30 a.m. for readings from the News and Observer. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience and readily available as a podcast after this broadcast. Thank you for listening.